The All Souls Forum is a public forum dealing with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world and that promote critical thinking. It is a production of the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church at 4501 Walnut Street in Kansas City, Missouri. While the All Souls Forum is on a summer hiatus, we will present programming of a similar nature. This week, we offer the Juneteenth special of Let's Talk About Race from KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
Welcome to a special Juneteenth edition of Grassroot News. I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke. Just what is Juneteenth?
Juneteenth means to me progression, transition.
Juneteenth, a cross between June and 19, commemorates the official end of slavery in Texas on June 19, 1865. That's over 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed into law by President Lincoln. News of their new freedoms was slow to reach some slaves throughout the country, and historians theorize that Texan slave owners suppressed the information in order to get one final cotton harvest from the slaves. On June 19, 1865, Major General Gordon Granger and Union troops arrived in Galveston to announce the war had ended and delivered General Order No. 3, which proclaimed that all slaves were free. The first official Juneteenth celebration took place in Texas a year later and became a state holiday in 1980. Juneteenth is celebrated in many ways, ranging from parades to cookouts and other activities. But Juneteenth isn't just about celebrations. It also serves as a time to further the conversation on the legacy left by slavery in the United States and as a means of discussing ways to address it, like the hotly contested topic of reparations.
We recognize our lineage as a generational trust, as inheritance. And the real dilemma posed by reparations is just that, a dilemma of inheritance. It is impossible to imagine America without the inheritance of slavery.
First sponsored by John Conyers in 1989 and reintroduced every session until his retirement in 2017, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act tries to tackle the subject. The bill is now sponsored by Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee in the House and Senator Cory Booker in the Senate.
Though I am gratified that we are having this hearing on Juneteenth, and for those of us who understand Juneteenth, 2 years after the proclamation, Emancipation Proclamation, there were those Africans who did not have freedom until 1865. H.R. 40 is in fact the response of the United States of America long overdue. Slavery is the original sin. Slavery has never received an apology. This commission would be comprised of members selected.
So enslavement built America, and the American Civil War was fought to keep slavery. This all started in 1619. History professor George Trent Vinson breaks it all down.
By 1619, 500,000 enslaved Africans had already made their way across the Atlantic, primarily to Brazil and Spanish colonies in South America and the Caribbean. So with that context, we see that slavery is not new, and we see that transatlantic slave trading is not new. That began in 1502. What is new about the 1619 Africans is that this is the beginning of a particular racialized slavery in what becomes English North America. For the 1619 Africans, what happens here is I think there's a realization that, oh, here we have a permanent labor force at our disposal. We don't have to release them after 4 to 7 years like they did the indentured servants. And in a labor-starved colony like Jamestown, I think people like Yardley and Piercy and other landholders see this as an opportunity. They don't necessarily speak the same language. The Africans are not, they don't share the similar cultural context. They have no home country of England to appeal to for rights to make claims of citizenship. And phenotypically, they look differently. They're easily marked out as a distinct labor class. And we see this in the labor categories of the early colony, where they're described as Negroes or servants not Christians, which is another way to describe them, to differentiate them in the records. So we have this combination of class and race coming together to create caste, a dynamic that presumes a permanent inferior group of people. And this is where we get the development of racial slavery. This is why Jamestown is so important for North American history. It's not that slavery was new, right? But it's this particular form of racial slavery that develops and what becomes America that creates that racial caste system and ideas, ideologies of white supremacy and black inferiority that continued over these 246 years of slavery and beyond. So the interesting dynamic of all of this, the result of all of this, is that by 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, America has 4 million enslaved people, which makes it the largest slave society in world history. And that began at Jamestown.
He happy because he's been here 200 years. Said, I'm just so thrilled to be here. Over here in America, I'm so glad y'all took me out of die, homie. I used to live to be 150. Now I die of high blood pressure by the time I'm 52. And that thrills me to death. I'm just so pleased America is gonna last. They brought me over here in a boat. There's 400 of us come over here. 360 of us died on the way over here. I love that. That just thrilled me so. I don't know, you white folks are just so good to us. Got over here, another 20 of us died from disease. But you didn't have no doctors to take care of us. I'm so sorry you didn't. Upset you all some too, didn't it? Then they split us all up. Yes, sir. We took my mom over that way, took my wife that way, took my kids over yonder. I'm just so happy. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do if I don't get 200 more years of this. Lord of mercy. That's so real. I don't know where my old mama is now. She up yonder in that big white folks in the sky. Y'all probably done forgot about it. But I ain't gonna never forget it.
At the edge of Central Park in Manhattan, there's a bronze statue of a doctor named James Marion Sims, whose brilliant achievement carried the fame of American surgery throughout the entire world. He's the guy who created the vaginal speculum, an instrument gynecologists use for examination. He pioneered the surgical repair for fistula, a complication from childbirth, and became known as the father of modern gynecology. But that brilliant achievement was the result of a series of excruciating experimental surgeries that he conducted on enslaved women. In a lot of ways, Sims epitomizes the story of American medicine for black women. It's a system that's failing them to this day. From infant mortality to life expectancy, the racial disparities in healthcare are staggering. The gulf between black and white might be widest when we look at maternal mortality, with black women 3 to 4 times more likely to die in connection with pregnancy or birth than white women. And that divide can be traced back to doctors like Sims, who contributed to a long, largely overlooked history of institutional racism in medicine.
Trying to understand a historical problem without knowing its history is like trying to treat a patient without eliciting a thorough medical history. You're doomed to failure.
That's Harriet Washington, a medical ethicist and author who chronicled the intersection of race and medicine in her book, Medical Apartheid. While many of the stark racial disparities in healthcare can be attributed to environmental and economic factors like access to good healthcare, studies show that minority patients tend to receive a lower quality of care than non-minorities, even when they have the same types of health insurance or the same ability to pay for care.
As African Americans, we've been abused for so long, consistently by the system. Why should we trust it? Why should we go to it when ill? And that's iatrophobia. That's a fear of the healer, you know, inculcated by the behavior of those healers, unfortunately.
It starts with slavery. Doctors relied on slave owners for financial stability. They accompanied plantation masters to auctions to verify the fitness of slaves and were called in to treat sick slaves to protect their owners' investments. In 1807, Congress abolished the importation of slaves and in turn pushed black women to have more children, to essentially breed slaves. Founding Father Thomas Jefferson later wrote,
I consider a woman who brings a child every 2 years as more profitable than the best man on the farm. Around the 1830s, the abolitionist movement led to the rise of what was called Negro medicine, or efforts to identify black inferiority to justify slavery. And there were polygenists who tried to use both science and the Bible to find proof that races evolved from different origins. The 1830s also marked the beginning of recorded experimentation on black women's bodies. One doctor performed experimental C-sections on slaves. Another one perfected the dangerous ovariotomy, or removal of an ovary, by testing the procedure on slave women. In fact, half the original articles in the 1836 Southern Medical and Surgical Journal dealt with experiments on black people. And then, of course, there was James Marion Sims, whose reputation is etched in history and on that statue in Central Park. Between 1845 and 1849, Sims began performing experimental surgeries on a 17-year-old slave named Anarka. He eventually performed 30 operations on Anarka and more surgeries on about 11 other female slaves. When his male colleagues could no longer bear to assist him in inflicting pain on the women, the slaves took turns restraining one another. Yet paintings depicting Sims, Anarka, and other slave women presented a subdued version of his experiments. Even though anesthesia was introduced in 1846, Sims chose not to use it for his experimentation with slaves. His practices echoed one of the most prevalent and dangerous beliefs in medicine at the time, that black people did not feel pain or anxiety. This book from 1851, titled The Natural History of Human Species, claimed the American dark races bear with indifference tortures insupportable to a white man. Studies released as recently as last year demonstrate that black people are less likely to be treated for pain, particularly in the ER. There's even one from a children's hospital that found the same to be true for kids. And just this year, Pearson Education, a leading educational publisher, issued an apology and recalled nursing textbooks that included racist stereotypes, like this section that said black people often report higher pain intensity than other cultures.
Well, what does it mean when you say that someone doesn't feel pain? Among other things, you're speaking about their humanity. These are all part of that suite of beliefs emanating from the 19th century that we still have not shaken off. Despite all our knowledge and sophistication, they're deeply ingrained.
Doctors like Sims might fit the Dr. Frankenstein stereotype, but they weren't outliers. Historically, Southern doctors who used black bodies for troubling experiments were the norm.
It's a very common question. How can we judge our forebears? You know, those guys in the 18th century who practiced medicine in a way that appalls us today. You know, we think, how could you do that? I did not judge the practitioners based on our own ethics. I judged them based on the ethics of their time. It was not acceptable back then. We just did not hear from the people who protested against it.
After the Civil War ended, the 1900s brought a wave of immigrants to the U.S. It sparked a race panic and coincided with the birth of the American eugenics movement. One of the movement's key objectives was to reduce the childbearing potential of the poor and disabled. Leaders included birth control pioneer and Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger, who eventually devised the controversial Negro Project, or family planning centers that pushed birth control in the Black South. It was a project that even garnered support from W.E.B. Du Bois, a founder of the NAACP, who wrote that black people bred carelessly and disastrously. By the mid-1930s, more than half the states passed pro-sterilization laws. And often, sterilization was forced. In 1961, future civil rights leader Fannie Lou Hamer went to the hospital to have a tumor removed, but was subjected to a hysterectomy without consent. The procedure, which rendered women infertile without their knowledge, was so common in the South that Hamer is said to have dubbed it the Mississippi appendectomy.
African-American babies were no longer economically valuable. And African-Americans themselves had gone from being a resource to a nuisance.
In June of 1973, the SPLC uncovered 100 to 150,000 cases of women who had been sterilized with federal funds in Alabama. Half the women were black. In recent decades, women of color continue to be exposed to dubious reproductive health programs. In December 1990, the FDA approved a contraceptive called Norplant, and it was selectively marketed to black teenagers in Baltimore schools.
You know, one of the current birth control methods now in the United States is Norplant.
Norplant fans like David Duke, the former KKK Grand Wizard, even introduced legislation to give women on welfare an annual reward of $100 if they agreed to get Norplant.
And it's time we start to encourage welfare mothers to be responsible.
That bill never passed. But the implant ignited a debate on whether long-term contraception, like Norplant that lasted 5 years, could be used as a form of social engineering when pushed to specific communities. Today, as we continue to lose Black mothers at alarming rates, a deeper look at the past may be a good step towards creating a more equitable healthcare system.
If you're just joining us, this is a grassroots news special on the holiday, Juneteenth. Now, you just heard from Richard Pryor and a Vox News piece on how the bodies of enslaved Black women advance medicine. Now, the labors of enslaved men and women also advance early capitalism in America.
The New York Times 1619 Project, which is spotlighting parts of history that are less well known. We are going to focus on some of the economic legacies, including the larger connections with modern capitalism. Specifically, we're going to look at how the production of American sugar, known as white gold, helped to fuel slavery and became ingrained in our society. Historian Khalil Gibran Muhammad of Harvard's Kennedy School wrote about that for the New York Times. Louisiana, he wrote, led the nation in destroying the lives of Black people in the name of economic efficiency. And he joins me now. Professor Muhammad, thank you very much for being here. Help us understand how sugar is connected to the origins of American slavery.
Sugar was the most dominant economic incentive for European colonization of the Americas. No other crop was as abundant or successful in drawing Europeans to these shores, and I mean by that North America and South America, for the purpose of cultivating sugar for a worldwide market, and particularly for Europe, that had already established a taste for sugar, but would grow exponentially in terms of demand over time. There's no way to really understand the significance of the colonization of the Americas without understanding the role of sugar in it.
And explain how slavery played such an important role from the very beginning.
Sure. So the origin story, of course, is that Christopher Columbus brings some cane stalks with him by way of the Spanish Canary Islands in 1493. So sugar is already part of the globe, but it has not become the commodity in bulk form that it will become once Christopher Columbus brings it to the New World. As such, sugar was always an incredibly difficult product to produce. First, the cane itself is heavy and unwieldy.
Right.
And secondly, to take the plant and turn it into sugar required incredible labor and often dangerous and difficult labor.
And you write about how, of course, that began in the 1600s, but then it went on literally for hundreds of years. It changed shape. You get closer to the Civil War, and the shape of the sugar industry has changed, but still slaves are an essential piece of it.
Absolutely. So Louisiana doesn't get into the business of sugarcane cultivation until the end of the 18th century. As a result of the attempt to cultivate sugar, it blossomed and bloomed. And by the top of the 19th century, Louisiana was producing about a quarter of the world's cane sugar supply. It was a pretty miraculous turnaround. But all of that was made possible by the enslavement of people of African descent.
And I know I'm asking you to skip over a lot of history here, but you move forward to today, to the 20th and even into the 21st century, and you write about how the legacy of what happened in Louisiana and other places still plays a role in the economy. A vital role in the economy of this country.
Well, if we go from sugar to cotton, we basically explain two crops that in their totality explain much of the infrastructure of our capitalist economy to this day. We can explain everything from the abundance of land that was originally held by the indigenous and the labor of enslaved people as America's competitive advantage. By the 19th century, cotton, for example, was essentially the major export of the United States. And that cotton export helped make possible the wealth not only in enslaved people, but also the wealth of banks in the North that were responsible for financing investments in this country that were often mortgaged on the basis of enslaved people. There's no way to really understand the economic might of America by the 19th century without understanding the role of cotton slavery and earlier sugar slavery in it.
They're one of the other writers for these series of articles in the Sunday New York Times. Matthew Desmond, he's a professor at Princeton, writes about how not only that today's economy has its roots in slavery, but that modern American capitalism is as severe as it is in its treatment of people, and that that too has its roots in slavery. Some people are going to look at that and say, is that a leap too far? How do you answer that?
Well, it's a good question, and I can see why people would give pause. But if we take a step back and we really ask a fair question, we could ask ourselves, has our economy been built on the notion of personhood or profit? And in that sense, from slavery to the late 19th century of immigration of Europeans from around the world to the 20th century today, people have been ground up in our economy for the purpose of money making. How else would you explain the great labor unrest of the late 19th and early 20th century that brought us essentially our modern social welfare system, eventually in the New Deal, but for the fact that capitalism created misery for people at the lowest end of the economic totem pole? That's our history, whether we like it or not. Some people prospered in that system, but it was a system that was often quite brutal to workers who were responsible for doing the heavy lifting of our economy.
Finally, why is it important, Professor Muhammad, that Americans understand what you've written about?
Well, it's important because we don't treat our past with the same commitment to truth and honesty and accuracy as we do, say, science and technology. If there's a concern in this day and age about the questioning global warming or climate change, if scientists are under attack for making things up, that's a new phenomenon, a product of our late 20th century. But we've been having culture wars about how to interpret the American past from the very beginning. And the consequences of that are what drove the editors of the 1619 Project to look closely at the work of academic historians, just like many people look at the work of scientists and say, what do academic historians tell us about the past that we have not been teaching and we've not learned as well as we should?
Khalil Gibran Muhammad, he's a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School, one of the writers for this New York Times series, the 1619 Project, looking at the 400th anniversary of the beginning of slavery.
Wading in the water, wading in the water,
wading in the water, wading in the water, children, wading in the water. God is going to trouble these waters, wading in the water, wading in the water, children, wading in the water. God is going to trouble these waters.
See that band all dressed in white.
God is going to trouble these waters.
It looked like a band of the Israelites.
God is going to trouble these waters. Wading in the water. Wading in the water, children. Wading in the water. God is going to trouble these waters.
See that band all dressed in red.
God is going to trouble these waters.
Look like a band that Moses led.
God is going to trouble these waters, wading in the water, wading in the water, children, wading in the water. God is going to trouble these waters,
my Lord, deliver Daniel.
Daniel,
did my Lord deliver Daniel? washed all night till he couldn't wash him no more.
Welcome back to our special on Juneteenth. My name's Lenita Duke from Grassroot News. This is sort of a journalistic roundtable, sort of explaining what Juneteenth is, the antecedent for Juneteenth, and where we stand as a nation, as the enslaved people of America stand up.
Where is she? Come on back, peaceful.
Easy now.
I'm gonna be free with God.
I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders, a bullet in my gun. Oh, I got eyes in the back of my head, just in case I have to run. I do what I can when I can while I can for my people, while the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night. That's when I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on keeping on. I can feel it in my bones.
You have made it 100 miles to freedom. Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Paratum.
Early in the morning, before the sun begins, we're gonna start moving towards that separating line. I'm wading through muddy waters. You know I gotta made up mine, and I don't mind if I lose any blood on the way to salvation. And I'll fight with the strength that I got until I die. So I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home, far across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on keeping on.
Harriet, welcome to the Underground Railroad.
Take my people with me.
The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates. If you are familiar with the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, it is through his nonfiction, like his book, Between the World and Me, winner of the National Book Award in 2015. Or perhaps even more impactful, his work as a journalist with the seminal article in The Atlantic, The Case for Reparations. But now Coates has written his first novel called The Water Dancer, and it is 400 pages of unfolding secrets about the enslaved, who are called the tasked, the enslavers called the quality, and poor whites who are called the low. Perhaps there is a trend emerging in fictions about slavery that The Water Dancer and Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, the National Book Award winner for fiction in 2016, represent. And that is an exploration of the interior of both the enslaved and the enslavers in ways that are as complicated and conflicted as race relations are today. And the interesting fact that both writers have chosen to embellish their narratives with magical realism. The protagonist and narrator of The Water Dancer is Hiram, a young enslaved man who is the offspring of the rape of his enslaved mother, Rose, by the master of the plantation, Hal Walker. The huge plantation is called Lockless and is located in Virginia. There are no dates mentioned, but the reader can know that it happens during the time of Moses, aka Harriet Tubman, because she looms large and active in the novel. And what a strong debut novel it is, with twists and turns about the nature of enslavement, which is called The Coffin. In fact, The Water Dancer would make an excellent Christmas gift for Kanye West, because it certainly destroys his stupid and despicable comment that slavery was a choice. The story opens with the inciting incident of a terrible accident in which a carriage driven by Hiram heaves off a bridge into the river late at night. Hiram, who is the servant and protector of his all-white, slightly older half-brother, Maynard, is in the water desperately fighting for his life, and at the same time, Maynard, who cannot swim, is commanding, then begging Hiram to rescue him. Out of this turmoil, which ends in a tragedy, we are taken back in time to learn their relationship, and Hiram's story begins to unfold. A great deal of the story is about the underground that Hiram becomes intricately involved in after he discovers he's about to be sold by his father and runs. But there is the very important overarching theme of family that runs throughout this novel that is so ironic to what has been depicted as the instability of family in the institution of slavery. Of course, enslaved families were unstable, but enslaved people still did everything they could to keep their families together. Coates seems to do everything he can in this story to drive home the fact that family meant absolutely everything to the enslaved, that slave masters did not make sure enslaved women were impregnated just to produce more slaves, but it was the essential weapon used to make sure their enslaved women and men were less likely to run, to manipulate and control them. If they were non-compliant, their children, a parent, or a family member were threatened to be harmed or sold. The Water Dancer gives the reader something to think about, especially now when the holidays are upon us, when so much is focused on commerce, giving, and getting, when perhaps for all of us it's really all about family. I highly recommend Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Water Dancer for two reasons. First, because it's well written, filled with mystery. You never know what the next chapter will reveal. The second reason is because if you love books like I do, you also love certain authors, and you want to know the body of their work. Ta-Nehisi Coates is a writer producing at a very high level because he's a thinker, does the research, and doesn't flinch at the truth. Now, the book does have flaws. I found it a little too long, sprawling at times with too numerous characters, a bit redundant here and there. But even so, it's a great read. It's exciting. And if Coates is an author you respect, you really need to dig into that first novel for yourself to imagine how great his next novel could be.
Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think between the Negroes of the South and the women of the North all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. That man over there says women need to be helped into carriages, lifted over ditches, and to have the best place everywhere. Nobody helps me into carriages or carries me over mud puddles or gives me any best place, and ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. I have plowed, I have planted, I have gathered into barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much, eat as much, when I could find it, and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most of them sold into slavery. And when I cried out with a mother's grief and none but Jesus could hear me, ain't I a woman? They talk about this thing in the head. What's that they call it? Intellect. That's it, honey. What's intellect got to do with women's rights or Negroes' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint, and yours holds a quarter, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? That little man in black back there, he says women can't have the same rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where does your Christ come from? Where does your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. So if the first woman God ever made could turn the world upside down all alone, then these women together ought to be able to turn it right back side up again. And now that they asking to do it, men ought to let them.
This is Nia Gray with a special faith report to commemorate Juneteenth. Juneteenth is a 155-year-old holiday celebrating the emancipation of African Americans from slavery in the United States. It would be remiss not to discuss the relationship between white Christianity and slavery. Racism began with slavery. For hundreds of years, so-called Christian white Southern slave owners used the Bible to legitimize and justify slavery. Even an article in the Charleston Mercury in the 1800s claimed that Jesus supported slavery. There were many common arguments made by Christians at this time. One is the fake teaching that Ham, the son of Noah, had black skin because he was cursed by Noah into servitude for his brothers, i.e., being a slave. This teaching was used to justify racism and slavery of people with dark skin across the world. It has been used throughout history in Nazi Germany and apartheid South Africa. This is false doctrine. Noah cursed Canaan, not Ham. These slave masters used charitable and evangelical reasons like slavery brings heathens to a Christian land where they can hear the gospel. Christian masters provided religious instruction for their slaves. They taught the Bible to encourage slaves to be good slaves. However, black and white Christian abolitionists who were biblically literate, like Frederick Douglass and the English Baptist pastor Charles Spurgeon, spoke out against slavery. In fact, Spurgeon said, "I do from my inmost soul detest slavery. And although I commune at the Lord's table with men of all creeds, yet with a slaveholder I have no fellowship of any sort or kind. I would soon think of receiving a murderer into my church as a man-stealer." This made Spurgeon public enemy number one throughout the southern states. Anti-Spurgeon bonfires burned his anti-slavery writings. Anyone who sold Spurgeon's sermons in North Carolina faced imprisonment for circulating incendiary publications. Can you imagine a white evangelical pastor today standing up with Black Lives Matter with anti-racist sermons and having Trump and white nationalist evangelical people issuing death threats to him? I encourage all people of faith to use this example. Don't let false doctrine poison your mind. And our faith supports social justice in every form. Happy Juneteenth. You've been listening to the Grassroots News Special on the Juneteenth holiday.
You know, the impact of slavery is with us in America, in our institutions, in the school, in the way the police department runs, in the way people of color, particularly African Americans, are hired in this country or not hired. These same companies that are promoting Juneteenth are the same companies and cities and counties who discriminate against black people in the way they are hired, if they are hired at all. And once hired, how often are they promoted? Slavery is in our DNA, not only in our institutions, but within us personally in our DNA. I wrote a satire years ago, and I called it Jeff Sessions' DNA Bleaching Kit.
Have you taken a DNA test from a direct-to-consumer ancestry testing site, such as 23andMe, Ancestry.com, FamilyTree DNA, or GED Match? Did the results conflict with your family history by saying you had African, South American, or Asian blood? Did the results contradict with what you look like in the mirror or your family history? Well, don't let those DNA results stop you from loving Trump, Robert E. Lee, Fox News, or the Confederate flag. Purchase a Jeff Sessions DNA Bleaching Kit. At Jeff Sessions' DNA Bleaching Kit, we will remove all unwanted lineages from your DNA. We will pop out all those chocolate chips in your cookie mix or your DNA. Just reject the validity of those genetic tests and those unwanted DNA markers. To hell with the science and to hell with the algorithms. Forget history. Studies have shown that European Americans also have non-European ancestry. Now, this includes African, Native American, and Asian. The frequency of European Americans who carry African ancestry varies strongly by state. Now, European Americans with African ancestry are found at a much higher rate in the South than in any other parts of the United States. States with the most racial tensions are also the ones where the whitest people have black ancestors. The findings published in the American Journal of Human Genetics found that whites in the South were far more likely to have black ancestors than any other part of the country. Therefore, it does not matter if your great-great-great uncle raped a slave or that your DNA matches looks like an NBA basketball team. At Jeff Sessions DNA Bleaching Kit, the facts do not matter. It's what you feel. And what you see is who you are.
Welcome back to our final chapter as we celebrate and try to understand the holiday, Juneteenth. I'm your moderator, Lenita Duke from Grassroots News. In these final minutes of the show, I want you to reflect upon what caused this. The gasoline was already spilt in America in terms of how they treated black people and other people of color, and yet it was the death of George Floyd at the hands of the police department in Minneapolis that was the spark.
I'm through.
I know you were a nigga, you didn't listen.
That's the movie. My stomach hurts. My neck hurts. Everything hurts. There's water up. Please. I can't breathe all the time.
Shut up.
They will kill me, man.
Bro, with your feet on his neck, man, you get off the
ground. His nose is bleeding. Come on now.
That's wrong right there with feet on his neck.
Look at his nose.
You see your knee on his neck.
Yeah, you got your feet right on his neck, bro.
I cannot breathe.
You're just a grown guy. You're a tough guy. You're a tough guy. You're not even resisting the rest, bro.
His whole nose is
fall with him.
Bro, why you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing now. Put him in the car.
Don't kill me.
How long y'all gotta hold him down?
This is why you don't do drugs, kids.
It ain't about drugs, bro. Y'all understand that?
Y'all don't gotta put y'all
in his neck, bro.
Right.
He is human, bro.
His nose is bleeding.
You can put him in the car. That's a bum ass. Y'all know that. You don't gotta sit there with your knee on his neck, bro. Bro, he ain't crying, bro. You circulate like in a jiu-jitsu move, bro. You trapping his breathing right there, bro. Like, you don't think that what that is, bro? You don't think nobody understands that right there, bro? I train at the academy, bro. That's some bullshit, bro. Right, that's bullshit, bro. That's bullshit, bro. He's stopping his breathing right there, bro.
Yeah, can't breathe.
Okay, he's talking.
He's talking. Bro, but you can get him off the ground. You've been a bum right now. You can get him off the ground, bro. You can get him off the ground. You've been a bum right now. He enjoying that. He enjoying that shit right now, bro. You could have put him in the car by now, bro. He's not resisting arrest or nothing. You enjoying it. Look at you. Your body language explains it, you fucking bum.
It's the whites. They love
women. No, I already know that, bro. I trained with half of these bum ass dudes at the academy, bro. You know that's bogus right now, bro. You know it's bogus. You can't even look at me like a man because you a bum, bro. He's not even resisting arrest right now, bro.
His nose is bleeding.
You stopping his breathing right now, bro. You think that's cool? You think that's cool,
really
though,
not.
Right? What's your badge number, bro? You think that's cool right now, bro? You think that's cool though, bro? You're a bum, bro. You're a bum for that. You're a bum for that, bro. You get mad. You just sitting there stopping his breathing right
look
now.
Look at
you
him.
About to what go the out the now, bro.
Look at
bro.
Him.
Bro.
Get off of him now.
What is wrong with
you?
What the?
He got mace. He cannot breathe.
Come
get over here. No, first of all.
Look at him. He's not responsive right now, bro. Are you serious?
Check
you are just like
him
with that on
let
his
me
neck,
see
bro?
A pulse.
Is he breathing right now? Check his
Hold
pulse.
On, have this conversation.
Check his pulse. Okay. Check his pulse.
George Floyd died. And we all watched, helpless, to intervene. And the neighborhood, and the state, and the country, and the world exploded.
So, I've been seeing a lot of things talking of the people making commentary. Interestingly enough, the ones I've noticed that have been making the commentary are wealthy Black people making the commentary about you should not be rioting, you should not be looting, you should not be tearing up our own communities. And then there's been an argument of the other side of we should be hitting them in the pocket. We should be focusing on the blackout days where we don't spend money. But, you know, I feel like we should do both. And I feel like I support both. And I'll tell you why I support both. I support both because when you have a civil unrest like this, there are three types of people in the streets. There are the protesters, there are the rioters, and there are the looters. The protesters are there because they actually care about what is happening in the community. They want to raise their voices, and they are there strictly to protest. You have the rioters who are angry, who are anarchists, who really just want to shit up, and that's what they're going to do regardless. And then you have the looters. And the looters almost exclusively are just there to do that, to loot. Now, people are like, well, what did you gain? Well, what did you get from looting? I think that as long as we're focusing on the what, we're not focusing on the why. And that's my issue with that. As long as we're focusing on what they're doing, we're not focusing on why they're doing. And some people are like, well, those aren't people who are legitimately angry about what's happening. Those are people who just want to get stuff. Okay, well then, let's go with that. Let's say that's what it is. Let's ask ourselves why in this country in 2020, the financial gap between poor blacks and the rest of the world is at such a distance that people feel like their only hope and only opportunity to get some of the things that we flaunt and flash in front of them all the time is to walk through a broken glass window and get it. That they are so hopeless that getting that necklace, getting that TV, getting that change, getting that bed, getting that phone, whatever it is that they're gonna get, is that in that moment when the riots happen and if they present an opportunity of looting, that's their only opportunity to get it. We need to be questioning that why. Why are people that poor? Why are people that broke? Why are people that food insecure, that clothing insecure, that they feel like their only shot, that they are shooting their shot by walking through a broken glass window to get what they need? And then people want to talk about, well, there's plenty of people who pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and got it on their own. Why can't they do that? Let me explain to you something about economics in America. And I'm so glad that as a child, I got an opportunity to spend time at PUSH where they taught me this, is that we must never forget that economics was the reason that black people were brought to this country. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Do you understand that? That's what we came to do. We came to do the agricultural work in the South and the textile work in the North. Now, if I right now decided that I wanted to play Monopoly with you, and for 400 rounds of playing Monopoly, I didn't allow you to have any money, I didn't allow you to have anything on the board, I didn't allow for you to have anything, and then we played another 50 rounds of Monopoly, and everything that you gained and you earned while you were playing that round of Monopoly was taken from you. That was Tulsa, that was Rosewood. Those are places where we built black economic wealth, where we were self-sufficient, where we owned our stores, where we owned our property, and they burned them to the ground. So that's 450 years. So for 400 rounds of Monopoly, you don't get to play at all. Not only do you not get to play, you have to play on the behalf of the person that you're playing against. You have to play and make money and earn wealth for them, and then you have to turn it over to them. So then for 50 years, you finally get a little bit and you're allowed to play. And every time that they don't like the way that you're playing, or that you're catching up, or that you're doing something to be self-sufficient, they burn your game. They burn your cards. They burn your Monopoly money. And then finally at the release and the onset of that, they allow you to play and they say, okay, now you catch up. Now at this point, the only way you're gonna catch up in the game is if the person shares the wealth, correct? But what if every time you share the wealth, then there's psychological warfare against you to say, oh, you're an equal opportunity hire. So if I played 400 rounds of Monopoly with you and I had to play and give you every dime that I made, and then for 50 years, every time that I played, if you didn't like what I did, you got to burn it like they did in Tulsa and like they did in Rosewood, how can you win? How can you win? You can't win. The game is fixed. So when they say, why do you burn down the community? Why do you burn down your own neighborhood? It's not ours. We don't own anything. We don't own anything. Trevor Noah said it so beautifully last night. There's a social contract that we all have, that if you steal or if I steal, then the person who is the authority comes in and they fix the situation. But the person who fixes the situation is killing us. So the social contract is broken. And if the social contract is broken, what the? You broke the contract when you killed us in the streets and didn't give up. You broke the contract when for 400 years we played your game and built your wealth. You broke the contract when we built our wealth again on our own by our bootstraps in Tulsa and you dropped bombs on us. When we built it in Rosewood and you came in and you slaughtered us. You broke the contract, so your target, your Hall of Fame. As far as I'm concerned, they could burn this to the ground. And it still wouldn't be enough. And they are lucky that what black people are looking for is equality and not revenge.
Seeing his death unfold on television, hearing him cry out for his mother, saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe sparked all of this. Right in the middle of a pandemic that disproportionately impacted Black people, meaning Black people and other people of color, Native Americans included, were dying and are dying at a higher rate from this virus. And now we are in the streets protesting, demanding, and reminding Black Lives Matter. It was started by this, as well as 400 years of slavery, oppression. And so now everyone wants to be cool and declare a holiday. But let's make sure this holiday is not a gimmick, that there are real, substantial, and institutional changes in America that makes the American dream a reality for all of us, and not just a few, while the rest of us remain living in a nightmare.
Thank you for listening to the All Souls Forum. Stay tuned to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your Jazz Afternoon with KC, coming up immediately, followed by The Boogie Bridge with Jason Vivoni at 3 p.m. and the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 p.m. In the meantime, have a great day.